Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, our special Academy Awards issue. Teddy Wayne is here to discuss his novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine.
Johnny Valentine is supposed to be a musical singing prodigy. He is extremely talented. The forces beyond his control are turning him into something he's not.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Critic Karen James looks at the glory and costs of celebrity.
When you look at them and you envy them so much, there's this secret satisfaction when they fall.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Teddy Wayne is one of America's most accomplished and honored young novelists. He's got a new book. It's called The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. It's reviewed on our cover by another hot writer, Jess Walter, who says, Teddy Wayne has written a moving, entertaining novel that is both poignant and pointed, a sweet, sad skewering of the celebrity industry. I'm delighted Teddy's here to join us. Welcome, Teddy.
I'm honored and accomplished to be here.
All right. Celebrity industry, tell us, kind of a Justin Bieber-like figure. Or you must get really sick of hearing that, actually.
The Simon & Schuster lawyers and I are unaware of this individual. Everyone keeps, Justin Bieber, you say, is that his name?
Right, totally fictional,
yeah,
imagine, that's right. No resemblance to anyone living or dead.
Purely coincidental. Bieber or people like him are, to me, interesting characters and figures of late capitalist art. They are as much brands as artists themselves. They're heavily packaged and marketed. And I want to write about someone who is in the art world seemingly putting forth an artistic product that is, you know, unique and authentic to him, but is completely consumed by the industry around him.
And you do it in his voice. Tough. How old is he?
He's 11, almost 12. So really, Johnny Valentine, not Justin Bieber, is a collision of voices. There's the preteen innocent grammar of an 11-year-old. There's also the cynical, savvy marketing lingo of a veteran branding executive.
So the story he leads is the one that we kind of think we know about these very young kids. And they are talented. It's them and not somebody else. So they're not totally artificial constructs of our culture, or are they?
I mean, Johnny Valentine is supposed to be a musical singing prodigy. He is extremely talented. He's an excellent singer. Forces beyond his control are turning him into something he's not. He would like to be someone like Michael Jackson, or MJ as he calls him, but the way that the industry around him works, there's no way he can ever become that. He has to become a bubblegum pop purveyor.
So when he aspires or imagines himself as MJ, it's not that he thinks MJ was free of all the celebrity apparatus. It's actually MJ the artist.
Right. I mean, MJ himself was the person most warped by fame and childhood fame of probably anyone in history. So Johnny is so blinkered in his vision of what he wants out of life, he's unable to see the figure that MJ turned into, and sees only the amazing artistry.
And so he is surrounded by people who are kind of, you know, they're sort of incubating him, and they're also insulating him. How does someone like that, this is really the experiment you do, how does someone like that become a real person who can interpret reality for himself, distinguish reality from this total artifice?
I'm not sure it's totally possible when you're that much in the eye of the storm as Johnny is. He's managed by his mother, Jane, who's a very controlling yet still loving manager and mother. I don't think when you're that young and have that kind of exposure to fame that you can climb out of it. The only way is what the character Tyler Beats in the book, who's this paragon to emulate, an older 17-year-old musician who's had the same kind of success Johnny had at a young age and is already thinking at 17 of moving out of it as talent and into the producing side. He says something like, talent gets used and chewed up. Better be the one behind the scenes.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you kind of a literary art craft question. Mm-hmm. We'll get away from celebrity for a moment. You may remember when another really good young writer, Jonathan Safran Foer, mm-hmm. wrote a novel, Everything is Illuminated, and John Updike reviewed it in The New Yorker. And he said, you know, and the hero of that novel is 9 years old. And he said, we may have reached the point where you can't give the reader the 16-year-old Holden Caulfield anymore. We have to turn the clock back more. We have to make them ever younger to capture any idea of innocence. Is there something like that going on?
Absolutely. A few people suggested making Johnny older than 11. And I thought if you do that, you make him a true adolescent who's already past puberty. I wanted to make him actually a child, still in the last throes of pre-adolescence, but a child nonetheless. To make him older in book form, a movie might be different, but in book form would feel a little bit like cheating the reader, that here's someone who's already going through teenagedom and therefore should be able to handle the rigors of fame a little bit more cleanly than an 11-year-old could.
Now, Teddy, can you imagine the ideal really young person? I mean, you're a serious novelist. You're a prize-winning novelist who would read this book and relate, would hear an authentic 11-year-old's voice in it. Is that something you think about or worry about?
Are you saying a young reader,
a reader who's maybe as old as John?
I think it's not appropriate for below certain age. This should have a PG-13 label slapped on it. I think some younger readers have discovered it and picked it up, maybe inadvertently because they think it's a young adult book. I know Simon Schuster is planning to introduce it eventually to high schoolers. I think high school is probably the lowest age that it should be for. There's too many sex and drug scenes in this for young kids.
And do you hear from readers? You hear from young readers?
The only thing I've heard so far from very young readers is I created a fake Twitter account for Johnny called The Real Johnny, and a few Bieber and One Direction fans have actually started following him. I don't know if they know he's made up or not. They ask me questions like, do you love chocolate as much as I do? And I've been responding to them as Johnny Valentine. So I don't know if they're aware of the irony in that Twitter handle or rather the fictional quality of it even.
And you're a pretty young guy. Can you remember a period when the culture felt a little different? I mean, to me, I'm much older than you. Mm-hmm. It seems something we've always been aware of or warned about was this endless saturation of media and culture. But have we reached some tipping point difference in 2013 from, say, I don't know, 1997, where it actually is exponentially more and will warp people in a more profound way than it would even then, which doesn't seem so long ago?
I would think so. I'm, as you said, I'm only 12 years old, so I was born in the 2000s. I think, yes, since 97, a couple of things. The internet clearly is one thing that's accelerated the exposure of media and celebrity. Things like Twitter make anyone possible. Anyone can be a celebrity in their own little world. If Warhol's 15 minutes of fame was once the maxim, now it's more like you can become famous to 15 people in your social circle by posting your Instagram photo on Facebook or whatever. So the internet is one thing. I think reality TV has made the concept of celebrity for all of us possible, and plus a kind of celebrity that no longer means just talent or ambition or drive, but will you humiliate yourself on TV? Even as far back as 10 years ago, when Paris Hilton burst on the scene in the early 2000s, a lot of people were shocked that someone could become famous for being famous. Now that's almost de rigueur. I think we expect the Kardashians. We don't blink an eye anymore at that idea of someone selling themselves as a brand on TV, and we're still watching it.
My daughter is 21 years old. She just turned 21. She's a huge Kardashian fan. Mm-hmm. And when she was telling me about them and described one of them as having become famous by making a sex tape, the way you might have said, well, first Salinger wrote these short stories and then he wrote the novel.
Yeah.
As if that's just kind of part of the career path and a totally okay thing to do.
And who knows about the intentionality of that leaked sex tape and other things like that. That there's other paths to stardom now. And they can be rigged, and they're not quite as honorable as they might once have been.
Okay, so what about you, literary novelist?
I do have a sex tape.
Do you? Yeah. You share that.
I'm going to leak
it. This is the audio part.
Next on Monday, we're leaking it to coincide with this.
I mean, you won Writing Writers Award. It's a very big deal. You've nominated for major prizes. Does any of this culture we're talking about, of instant, incessant celebrity and exposure, does that impinge, quite apart from your subject matter, on the way you live your life as a writer? Are you still kind of doing the Kafka thing or the Hemingway thing? Is it possible?
Sam, I can't walk down the street without being tackled for no.
After you, man. You're in New York Magazine. Of course they're going to come after you.
No one knows who I am. No, in the book world and especially literary fiction world, even if you're a big deal in that world, which I don't consider myself to be. No one pays attention to you still. It's not you have it's a tic-tac in the ocean of real fame. That being said, when my first book came out, I went through what every writer goes through when your first book comes out, which is you're gratified and excited, but there's intense vulnerability to see this private thing you've been working on for years suddenly catapulted out to the world. and a bad Amazon review can get you all distraught. So I start thinking, what if someone like a real celebrity had, how do they handle the scrutiny? And then I was 31 when my first book came out. What if you were 13 or in this case 11 and had to deal with this kind of global attention?
Oh, so to some extent then, this novel really does grow out of your own consciousness. I'm being quite serious now as a writer and of this kind of sense of fragility and vulnerability and that something's being taken from you in some way.
Yeah, and again, let me be clear here. There's I was not, and I'm not now, on the level of a Johnny Valentine, even in my own world. But still, I think even if I'd self-published a book and saw an Amazon review, you'd get this kind of fragility, exactly as you say, of seeing it out there and then questioning, you know, is everyone being honest in their dealings with you? If someone responds to your emails now, why weren't they doing it a week before? You know, that sort of thing. So I can't imagine, well, I guess I tried to imagine in this book what it's like for a child to go through it, but it's got to be that much more intense. And when money's involved in the way that it's unfortunately not in the book world, then it becomes that much more pernicious too.
Teddy, you're Teddy. Your hero's called Johnny. You've written a back page for us about first names.
Yes.
Brothers. Tell us a little bit about it. We haven't published it yet, so you can give us a little bit of a sneak preview.
Sneak preview for the Times podcast listeners. The next week is the back page essay is The Importance of Authors' Names. My name is Teddy. My real name is actually Derek. I've always been called Teddy, though. And I just wrote a little essay about what makes a sort of authorial, writerly first and last name. There's various tricks and techniques I've learned as to what makes people stand out. Sometimes the three-letter name, the initialed name, the Jonathan conundrum, why there's so many Jonathans versus Johns now.
Franz and Latham for, yeah. It's right. Updike is a great little piece, which you actually kind of allude to, where he said, well, there's Hawks and Cheever and Irving, and that was just the Johns, he said.
That's in one of his novels, yeah, Back at Bay.
Yeah, which are great, fantastic stories. We'll never see anything like them again because the fixation on the Jewish writer has kind of disappeared from the culture. Listen, it's great to have you come in. Best of success for this really brilliant novel, and congratulations.
Thanks so much, Sam.
That's Teddy Wayne, whose new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hey, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
Fresh from your page one story this weekend, but now we're moving on to something else. That was about the short story. Now, more book publishing and bookstore wars. What's happening?
That's right. So a lawsuit last Friday from some independent booksellers claiming that Amazon and the Big Six publishers have colluded, so this is a class action antitrust suit, have colluded to keep them out of the digital book market. And they are raising some very interesting questions.
Okay, let's walk through this now. So the six publishers, we may not get them all, but that's Random House and Simon & Schuster and HarperCollins and Macmillan, Penguin.
Simon & Schuster.
Okay,
right.
So they, we think of often as kind of being at odds with Amazon, but the independent book sellers are sort of lumping them all together as the villains. How are they colluding? What are they doing exactly?
Well, in order to sell their books digitally, they all sign contracts, which are not public, with Amazon separately. And they essentially allowed Amazon to code their books so that you can only purchase them if you have a Kindle or a Kindle app.
That's right, if you want to read it as an ebook.
Obviously, you can purchase those books from other places with other codes. But the question is, if you buy a Kindle and you later on want to download a digital book not from Amazon, let's say you want to download it from a private bookseller, you cannot currently do that. So if you buy the Kindle device, you cannot go in an independent bookstore and download books from them. In other words, Amazon has kept a lock on a certain part of the market, and the independent bookstores say, this just isn't fair. There's no reason for this. There's certainly not a technological reason for it.
Okay, now explain to me first, Leslie, why someone would go to an independent bookstore, or how would they do it, and get an ebook? Don't you go to an independent bookstore and buy something off the shelf?
Well, you sure do. But they also, and they have very loyal customers. But from those very loyal customers, they also want the future, which is in part digital books. And they have built up websites and they have kiosks in the store so that if you see a store and you want to buy something digitally, like you want it on your iPhone, you don't want to carry it around, they want to be able to service that market as well.
So they're actually doing this now. You could walk into an independent bookstore and buy an e-book there.
You could. What you cannot do is buy the book there and play it on your Kindle, which could be problematic.
Okay, so there is a lawsuit that's been filed. Have we heard any response from Amazon and the Big Six? What do they say in return?
Well, Amazon and the Big Six are very silent. Only one of them, Simon & Schuster, called it a frivolous lawsuit. But the one thing that makes it seem a little less frivolous is there were similar lawsuits against Apple and music business, which is Apple had originally coded individual songs so that you had to play it on the iPod. They were sued, and now it's open source.
So that could be a precedent then.
Right. That's what they're arguing. They're arguing that there is a precedent in this, that they cannot keep doing this.
So, all right, one of the Big Six publishers has spoken out. You say everyone else, including Amazon, has been silent on this?
Right. They're just saying it's litigation and we won't talk.
But they must be preparing some kind of defense.
Oh, I'm sure they're preparing some kind of defense. I don't think they're necessarily scared. What's so interesting about this lawsuit is it was brought about by the son of one of the independent booksellers, a woman who has a bookstore in Albany. And her son has grown up in the bookstore and loved it. He went to law school, and he originally put together the original pieces of this lawsuit. So we'll see. It's been picked up by a real law firm, however, and we'll see if it has legs.
And we haven't heard anything from the U.S. Justice Department or anybody.
No,
like
we're
that.
Still very early. They filed it in U.S. District Court last Friday. It'll take a while, the Southern District of New York, so
well,
Manhattan.
Sometimes those small, trivial-seeming cases can work their way through the labyrinth.
That's why we're keeping an eye on it for you.
Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thanks, Sam.
Continuing our theme of celebrity, there's a new book called Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. It's by Ty Burr, and it's reviewed for us by someone who knows a lot about movies, fame, television, books, you name it, Karen James, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be here.
Okay, so what is Burr doing here? Is he telling us anything we don't know? Is he telling us about people we don't know?
He's actually doing a cultural history of movie stardom and fame. And I approach this book very skeptically, saying, tell me something I don't know.
Right, because you review many books here. You were an editor at the Book Review, my first editor. You were a television critic here. And you kind of know this field. So
I know this field more than most readers. And he did tell me some things I didn't know. But most of all, what I like about this book is that he traces not only the evolution of movie stardom from silent movies to today, but raises a lot of provocative questions about what fame means today in a really thoughtful way and looks really closely at the paradoxes. We love stars, we hate them. We want to be them, and we feel superior to them. And that's actually a very complicated dynamic that he gets at very well in a book that's also really entertaining.
And Karen, so he goes back to the beginning, those first silent gods and goddesses?
He goes back to the silent days and actually unearths something that I didn't know about, which is that in 1910, an actress named Florence Lawrence was the first movie star to create a mob scene, which was orchestrated by Carl Laemmle, the famous producer who had her under contract. And a fake obituary ran of Florence Lawrence, and then Laemmle got to write a retraction saying she's alive and she will be in St. Louis on such a date. So she got off the train and there was a mob that approached her and pulled buttons off her coat, and it was the first scene of what we now recognize as paparazzi chasing people down the street.
Well, that's so interesting, because what it shows you too is from the beginning this idea of the celebrity and star was already sort of in the air.
It was in the air, and what Burr points out is that people wanted to see that she was real. They wanted that larger-than-life person to be among them and to be human and to see that she really was there. But then they kind of pulled her apart and went after her as if they owned her. And he traces that not only from the silent days through all the changes in the nature of fame in the 30s and 40s onto the 70s when the culture was very different, onto today, when the stars have literally become small pictures on your cell phone. And it reminds you of the famous line from Sunset Boulevard when Gloria Swanson says, she's still a big star from the silent days. It's the pictures that got small. And now the pictures are literally small. They're the size
of
your iPhone.
Yeah. So interesting. So does this alter the life or the experience of the star, or are they still somehow larger than life and living? Do we still project these enormous fantasies on them?
He doesn't really go into how it affects them. He's concerned with how it affects us and how it affects the culture. And there's a huge change in the nature of fame, because now anybody can be famous. Anybody who can make a YouTube video and have it go viral is a star. So it devalues the nature of fame, according to him. If everybody can be famous, maybe nobody's really famous.
And is that such a bad thing? Or is should there be people who are truly famous? Does this have to do with the idea of talent and accomplishment, that there are those we should look up to because they've truly earned the admiration of the nation or a mob, and that now that's just become a cheap sort of currency?
Well, you can look at it that way, but only if you think that movie stars really were that. And in fact, they weren't. They were manufactured images by the old Hollywood studios. So maybe it was always a fantasy that we projected on them, that they were bigger and better than we are. And now you have a whole different range of kinds of fame. So you have maybe the old-fashioned model, which is a George Clooney model. He's the guy we project all our wonderful fantasies are. Or Ben Affleck, who is not only talented but politically aware. And then you have the Kardashians. And they're the different kind of famous, where you laugh at them, but don't you in a little way want to be that rich or have that kind of celebrity? So it becomes more fraught when it becomes more down-to-earth and tackier, frankly.
Now, Karen, what about this whole side that you mentioned and we emphasize in our headline, the kind of hostility we have or we project onto these stars? We envy them, we like them, but to suffer publicly or put them through rituals of apology, is that something that also traces back to the beginnings of our celebrity culture?
If you look back, the audience turns really quickly on stars. They want Charlie Chaplin to be the little tramp. They don't want him to be a person in real life who lives with a woman he doesn't marry. They turn on people very quickly, or who has a taste for younger women. They don't want Ingrid Bergman to run off with Rossellini. So I think there's this dynamic, even in the early days, when you look at them and you envy them so much, there's this secret satisfaction when they fall. So I think you do trace that back, but there's much more of it now because we know more about Lindsay Lohan and about every twist and turn of rehab. There are no secrets anymore.
And are we as punitive now? I guess we are. We've always had this kind of – it's almost a kind of puritanical need to punish these people who provide us with glamour and excitement and pleasure.
I don't know if we're punitive in exactly the same way. Maybe it's less puritanical than it was. But I think we turn on them just as easily. And if you look at something like, look at any tabloid where you see stars without makeup or you get a shot of somebody's cellulite on the beach, people eat that up because it's the other side that gives you some satisfaction. You're not as rich as they are. You're not as famous. But look, maybe you're thinner or maybe you're saner.
And Karen, is he writing mainly about the American phenomenon or does he look at some of the European gossip magazines really far worse than anything
we have?
He's
really looking at American culture, and he looks very closely at the way in which fame interacts with American society and gives each era the image that it wants and maybe unconsciously needs. So that, for instance, as I point out in the review, Clark Gable was an image of very strong masculinity at a time when post-war, during the Depression, maybe a lot of men felt emasculated. It creates images that American society responds to. Betty Davis was an image of a strong woman at a time when women found that idea kind of radical and maybe inspiring. So that things change throughout the culture, but he's looking very specifically at the interaction of American culture with movies.
What about the huge transcendent figures? You mentioned Chaplin, Marilyn Monroe, in some ways still the greatest
movie goddess of all. What are the qualities, in your view, I've set the book aside, or maybe he does, Burr does discuss it, that make some of these figures actually defeat time in some way and last decade after decade, new generations come along and still respond to this star?
You know, that's one of those things that is so hard to put your finger on. It's partly charisma. It's partly this presence on screen. And it's partly the ability for, I think, different eras to respond to something different in those figures. Every era responds to Marilyn Monroe in a different way. She was the sex symbol in her own day. Later, she was picked up as maybe a feminist icon of an image of someone who was not treated as well as women should have been.
In fact, there was a book about Elizabeth Taylor as a kind of proto-feminist in some ways.
Exactly. So that I think it's that ability to be a rich enough figure so that every culture finds something different that they respond to. And in fact, they don't stay the same image all the way through. It's a different Marilyn Monroe for every era. And I think Burr doesn't look at it so much in terms of their images as they evolve, but that's definitely part of what he's talking about.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Great to be here.
That's Karen James, who reviews Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame in this week's book review.
This is Parul Sehgal, and I'm joined by Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Parul.
So what's selling?
Well, the indomitable march of literary short stories continues. Karen Russell's new book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, hits the hardcover fiction list at number 15 this week. Then at number 13, pretty much the opposite end of the spectrum, Jackie Collins has a new book, The Power Trip, new at number 13. Then at number 10, Alex Berenson, a former Times reporter, now a spy novelist, has the latest in his John Wells series. It's called The Night Ranger, new at number 10. At number 9, a book translated from the Dutch called The Dinner by Herman Koch. That is a book that's getting some comparisons to Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, a book that's being called The Dutch Gone Girl. Then at number 4, Jonathan Kellerman is new on the list with a novel called Guilt. And new at number 1 this week, Maeve Binchy, who died last July, her final novel, A Week in Winter, hits the list. She, of course, is the Irish novelist. She wrote Circle of Friends and a number of other books, including Tara Road, which was an Oprah Book Club selection. Mm-hmm. So this looks to be her final book, and it hits the list at number 1. Then on the nonfiction side of things, another former Times reporter, Charlie LaDuff, has a book out called Detroit, An American Autopsy. LaDuff was born and raised in Detroit. And after he left the Times, he ended up back in Detroit, first writing for a small paper there. And now he's working as a television reporter for the local Fox affiliate. And this is kind of a collection of reports that he's done through the years, looking at Detroit and how it's run down. Then at number 9, the former Los Angeles Dodger and New York Met Mike Piazza, great slugging catcher, has a memoir written with Lonnie Wheeler called Long Shot. That's new at number 9. One above that on the hardcover nonfiction list at number 8 is a book called Drinking and Tweeting by the reality television star Brandy Glanville from The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Glanville is a former model. She became famous when her husband, the soap opera actor and TV movie actor, Eddie Cibrian, I think his name is.
I think it's Cibrian.
Cibrian. Oh, thank you, Parul.
Clearly, I've been following this much closer than I thought.
He left her for the younger country music singer, Leanne Rimes. Mm-hmm. And Glanville, during the course of that divorce, she went ballistic. And she started talking to tabloids for money. Partly, she says now, as a way to make money because she wasn't getting anything out of the divorce settlement. But the tabloids loved her, and they couldn't get enough. And they kept bringing her on to kind of these tabloid TV shows and the tabloid newspapers and paying her to talk. And she would go do these events. And she became such a kind of D-list celebrity that way that she was ultimately invited onto the Bravo Real Housewives series.
But all the while insisting that this was for her career.
Yes, okay. this is her way to make money.
So now she's a memoir,
her, I presume? Her book, Drinking and Tweeting, is kind of a dishy divorce memoir. It tells the story of her breakup and how she survived it. It also tells the story of how she became a celebrity out of humble roots. Her dad was a pot dealer. So that book is selling well. That's at number 8. Along the same lines, at number 3 this week, Amity Schlaze's biography of Calvin Coolidge.
Okay. It's not as similar.
Yeah, exactly. His rise to the presidency. And this is a book that's trying to rehabilitate Coolidge's reputation.
So much like Brandy is doing.
It's arguing that he's one of the great conservative presidents in U.S. history.
Wow. So can we chat a little bit more about Maeve Binchy? So she's a very beloved writer. Yeah.
Is she
a genre writer? Is she literary fiction?
She addressed that very question once in a profile in a British newspaper. She said that her books haven't really gotten the critical acclaim. She's not considered a literary writer. She did not consider herself a romance writer, largely because she didn't write sex. She said she didn't have a problem with sex. She quite liked it.
Yeah.
It's not that she was above, you know, writing about sex morally. But she said that she didn't have a lot of experience. I'm afraid I'll get it wrong, she said. I've never been in an orgy, and I wouldn't know where legs should be and arms should be.
Oh, that's funny. And these are big books. They're about like 600, 700 page doorstops.
Yeah, I don't know how big the new book is, but it's true. She often wrote kind of these epic family stories. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Parle.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.